Okay. Good morning. So I'm back. And over the last week, Campbell sort of went over how we're going to connect from what switches do, which is all about MAC addresses and doing stuff in the local network, to dealing with IP, which has to go between networks somehow. We're going to talk in a couple weeks about, maybe next week, about how we actually sort of configure going between networks. We talked about the mechanism, and we have these tables, and we have kind of separate tables for our MAC addresses and for our IP addresses. We call the tables for the IP addresses these routing tables. And with our IP addresses, unlike our MAC addresses, we organized our IP addresses into these ranges, and we saw this CIDR notation for representing these ranges of IP addresses. And we have entries for various ranges, and the routers look that up, or even end hosts look that up to figure out where do I send things, but the actual mechanism to send in the local network involves that MAC address. So we need to bridge that, and we have this idea of a neighbor table, sometimes called an ARP table, because ARP is the protocol used in IPv4 for this, that kind of bridges that, that matches those local MAC addresses to the IP addresses that we use between networks, and that even on the local network we mostly use in our applications. We're asking to contact our local, say, you know, if you're at home and you have a local router, you typically, the instructions for accessing it are going to say to enter its IP address, not enter its MAC address somewhere. And these routing tables kind of importantly deal with getting to other networks. And so in some cases, we will be sending stuff to a MAC address where the machine we're sending it to, that MAC address, doesn't belong to the IP address we actually wanted to get to. It's going to have to go some additional steps. That machine would be a router. And very commonly, we'll call these routers gateways. And kind of the big case where that comes up is kind of our default network configuration. It's sort of a typical device that is connected to just one network. The most common case, we need to know it has an IP address that it uses as its source IP address. It needs to know what range of IP addresses belong on the local network. And for addresses that aren't on that local network, we generally have this kind of what we call default route, an entry in our table that matches anything that wasn't matched before that goes to a particular gateway on the local network. So, you know, think of our kind of classical, you know, most common home network in the US is that you have a router that you or your ISP provides that connects to your external connection, and on the internal side, you know, it's the gateway that we contact. And we talked about these tables, and one thing we need to do is we need to configure these tables. And even in the case where the table was very trivial, where we're not going to have to do funny things to figure out all the different networks connected, which we'll talk about later, as I mentioned, but even in the trivial case, we need some mechanism where I don't need to, each time I take my laptop to Starbucks, type in the IP address for my laptop, the IP address of the gateway, and all that stuff. We automate that process. We have this auto configuration. And kind of the basic mechanism for that is that there's some way of broadcasting onto the local network to say, hey, I just joined here, tell me how to connect. And there'll be some machine on the local network that will respond to that and give the sort of basic information we need, the IP address, the default route, also some other information that will become more relevant later in the class, like DNS servers, so we can churn names that you type into IP addresses. And in IPv4, this is done with DHCP, which actually tells you your exact IP address along with all that other information. In IPv6, they realized that was kind of ugly. And they have this idea of stateless auto-configuration. And stateless means that we don't have anyone explicitly tracking what machines are on the network. Instead, you just learn this network starts with this prefix, and you choose an address within that prefix. Sort of the default way this used to be done is that you use your MAC address to choose that, so it's guaranteed unique. We've since realized that having your IP address give your MAC address everywhere in the world is maybe not great. especially if like we're concerned about advertisers or adversaries tracking us. So typically what modern machines do is they'll choose a random address, and most of the time that just works. But sometimes they'll advertise that random address using neighbor discovery and find out, oh, someone else also has this address, in which case they'll just choose another random address. Okay. So questions about these topics from last week? And why is this making lots of noise? But, okay, and I guess there's one topic that Campbell mentioned he spent time covering, and I saw in the recording, came up a bunch, that I kind of glossed over, which was NAT, Network Address Translation. We'll talk about that more in the future. I have it on the schedule for November. I think I'll move that up to when we talk about what the API for connecting TCP sockets are, and we talk about like what packets get exchanged to set up a TCP connection, because it's connected to that. So with Network Address Translation, the reason it comes up is that when you use your typical networks here, you realize, oh, my IP address isn't the same one the global internet sees what's going on, and there's some translation going on. The reason we're not talking about that right now is because that translation involves tracking individual connections, not machines, right? IP addresses identify machines, but that translation involves kind of separately tracking each connection and what machine it belongs to. So to understand how that works, we need to think about how the connection process works. And so that's why I chose to like cover that a bit late. Okay, so any questions about things from the last week? All good. And as a reminder, there's a reliable 2 is due on Friday, so any questions about that? Okay, so in that case, we'll dive into sort of congestion control. And last time, Campbell introduced kind of this idea of congestion control, which is that, you know, we optimally want to get our window size in this kind of location up here, where we're kind of getting our maximum throughput, but not overloading the network, that we're basically gonna fill the pipe. We're gonna, you know, basically use the bandwidth delay product. And we have this kind of silly algorithm we can use to do that, which is that we know the way our network behaves is that when we're below the capacity the network can accept, we're gonna have no packet loss and we're gonna have lower latency. When we're above, our latency is going to start to spike, and we're going to have lots of packet loss. So something we could do, and that is really done, is that when we start a connection, we can just check, you know, okay. We just try things and see if we get that low loss rate or high loss rate, and kind of binary search, and discover, oh, we probably want to operate in this region. That would be kind of the intuitive thing to do. And this is kind of going to be the basis of our approach, that we're going to take advantage of this observation, that if we try things, we can see, based on the results, are we below or above that capacity? But there's going to be some challenges. And one of the challenges is that in this kind of region here, if we try something really high, we're going to pay for it. That we talked about, he mentioned, you know, this paper talks about the series of congestion collapses they had on the early internet, that LBNL and UC Berkeley, which, you know, are just up a hill. You can, like, see one from the other. Had, you know, 40 bits per second of, 40 bits per second of effective bandwidth on a 32 kilobit per second link, because too many things were trying to operate in this high region, basically. And so there were a bunch of things that they did to kind of fix this. And there's been more things that have happened since. So congestion control, I would say, is still kind of even an active area of research. So how do you like solve this problem? But the basic stuff was kind of discovered out of necessity after these congestion collapses. They realized we can't use the original version of TCP as is. We need to change how the sender acts to avoid having this congestion collapse happen. And what makes this challenging is that it's not enough to just do this experiment and then say, okay, we found this size, we're going to operate there. That's not good enough. And the reason that wasn't good enough is because we can have this variation. And this is what Campbell left you off with last time, that we can have, say, our two machines here, left to right, they have 10 megabits between them when the network is quiet, but then someone else starts using bandwidth, and we have this kind of shared bottleneck here. And what's going to happen is that they're going to notice, oh, I'm losing packets because buffers are getting full, probably over here. Right, that first switch there is going to start filling its buffers because we have 13 megabits going in. And what we want to happen is we want our left to right flow to reduce from 10 to 7 megabits. But in our datagram-based design, we don't actually have a direct mechanism to tell it to do that. So I mentioned we had this idea of virtual circuits. And a reason virtual circuits are appealing is that in virtual circuits, we'd have a table at each of these switches saying, oh, there's a connection from the left machine to the right machine that needs 10 megabits. And when you started setting the 3 megabits, you try to add to that table, and the switch could notice, oh, this is too much. Why don't you stop? But we don't do that. We deliberately decided not to do that. And part of this was kind of the end-to-end principle, that we don't want to rely on all this sophisticated functionality in the middle of our network. Another part of it is just scalability. If you tried to do this virtual circuit scheme for like a major tier one ISP, you would need to have a switch that tracks, you know, millions of virtual circuits. That's not going to be feasible to do quickly. So we don't do that. So we're going to have to rely on some indirect signals to automatically figure out, I'm sending too much. And we want to figure it out quickly, because if we don't figure it out quickly, we're going to be in that congestion collapse scenario. And we also have the opposite situation. So let's say this is happening for a while, and we successfully somehow adapt down to 7 megabits. Then this 3 megabit transfer stops, and we want to go back up to 10 megabits. We don't want to just leave that bandwidth unused. So we also need to somehow figure out the bandwidth is back there without intervention. And we're not going to have help from the network to do this, from the switches directly to do this. We're going to have to rely on these kind of indirect signals. And we're going to use that signal of drop rate to do that. And a third issue we're going to talk about more explicitly later is that I'm kind of saying, oh, we have this 3 megabits we have to adapt to, but what's really going to be happening most of the time is that that network connection is also going to be adapting to us, and this overall behavior needs to result in sort of the right amount of bandwidth being used by everyone. So we're going to ignore that problem of what happens when they're adapting to us. For now, we'll talk about it explicitly later. But it is an important concern, right? Because as we said more, they're going to throttle back. And that phenomenon is actually part of the reason for that congestion collapse, is that when you send too aggressively, you know, that overloads the network. But also, when you send too aggressively, that causes everyone else to throttle back. And when if you throttle back too aggressively, everyone throttles back too aggressively. So how do we, you know, have a good idea that we're going to actually have everyone kind of converge to actually using the network and using a kind of fair portion of it? So I'm going to focus on what would probably be item 5 in the paper as kind of our first part. I don't think that Jacobson organized these. I think he organized these probably in order of what they did, not what the relative importance is. And we're going to focus on handling the steady state. So some of these things, I guess I'll give a brief overview here. So we're not going to, one here is round trip time variance estimation. So in our assignment, we told you to estimate the round trip time and then set the time out to twice that. That's kind of a hack. Like, do we actually know twice is enough? And TCP originally had this problem where they had something like that twice and they didn't know twice was enough. And what you really should do is you should try to get an estimate of not just the moving average, but also the moving average of the variance, so you know what high enough round trip time is. So that's fix one, simple fix. But it turns out they had a high variance because of queuing. Queuing delay varies a lot, and this was causing them to get spurious timeouts because of that. So that was fix one. Fix two is that when you have a full timeout, you don't, and you have another timeout, you have a series of timeouts, you want to actually increase your timeout over time so you avoid overloading the network by just retransmitting after a timeout. So that was that fix there. Slow start, we'll talk about more explicitly later. It is the least well-named thing on the slide. And it's how we're gonna set the initial window size. But for now, we're going to focus on what I'll call the steady state. We're going to say we already have our connection established. We found the current optimal window size, but something's changing, and we should go lower or higher. How are you going to figure that out? This, I think, we'll skip, and we'll talk about fast retransmit later, and I'll probably skip number 6. So, as I said, we're going to talk about steady state. And we're going to talk about window sizing based on the steady state. And we're going to use that experimentation idea, that idea that we can figure out if we're at the capacity or not by noticing that we're going to have some losses when we go over it, and we're going to have no losses when we're under it. Now, this means that in order to detect if we're at the capacity, we need to deliberately trigger losses. And this may be very disappointing to you, right? That we're going to deliberately go into that danger area where we're going to start to make packets get lost and possibly for other connections because there's a shared queue. But that's what we're going to do. And so what it's going to look like is that we're going to have our window size and we're going to sort of constantly experiment with increasing the window size slightly and decreasing it and increasing it. And when we have packet drops, we're going to decrease our window size because we know we're too high. But we're always going to constantly increase it slightly because otherwise we won't detect if we're too low or not. And so in this scenario, I have my cross traffic and my cross traffic increases briefly. And you can see I adapt to that based on, each time I have one of these packet losses, I decrease my window size. This is kind of the basic idea we're going to go for. Now, this basic idea, is pretty intuitive, but we have to figure out what are the details here. So, like, how fast can we increase? How fast do we need to decrease to make this work? But key ideas, we're always increasing the window size. We react to dropped packets by decreasing the window size. And that should get us roughly near the maximum bandwidth. We're not going to get the full maximum bandwidth inherently, and because inherently we actually need to have packet loss for this scheme to work. We're going to need to do retransmissions. That's just going to be normal. So questions on this kind of basic sort of experimentation idea and what we might call a sawtooth pattern that we're going to have. Yeah.
For the second raising period, why the slope actually got a little bit less? Because shouldn't the slope be more aggressive when you don't get packet loss for a while?
Shouldn't the slope be more aggressive when you don't get packet loss for a while? So that is a design choice that we could make. And there's a varying decision. So a question here about how aggressive my slope is. I've deliberately... This is kind of hand-wavy. What we're actually going to do is probably not going to do what you want. So you want to say, If we haven't got packet loss for a while, we should increase more aggressively. I think that's a very reasonable idea. That is not actually a common idea. I'm just showing sort of qualitatively what happens. We'll talk about the actual numbers later, and basically we're going to increase at a constant. For our first version, we're going to increase at a constant rate. It's true that kind of the schemes that are used on modern systems don't increase at a constant rate, and there's going to be a reason for that, but we're going to basically increase at a constant rate once we get to the steady state. Yeah.
If I understand right, the reliable part 3 is kind of implementing this idea, but in our like part 1 and part 2, it's more about completely reducing packet loss and it's kind of waiting to resend. But are we like kind of changing that idea in part 3 and just letting stuff drop as a means to lower the dynamic window?
So the question is, in reliable part 3, we're implementing this idea, but in part 1 and 2, like we're not expecting any packet loss and so on? Yes. So in part 1 and 2, the idea is we have an oracle that tells us what the optimal window size is. And if we know the optimal window size, we don't need to have any packet loss. But for part 3, we're going to need to deliberately trigger that, and we're going to have this sawtooth pattern. And most likely, this picture is very optimistic compared to what you're going to have happen on part 3. Probably on part 3, your diagram is going to look something more like this. And we're going to get like a lot less than the sort of full achievable bandwidth. There are schemes where you can get closer to that. That's not a requirement for part 3. Right? For part 3, we want you to implement the increase, decrease. We're not going to be picky about did we have to tweak it to be the most efficient it could be. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, other questions? Okay, problem solved. So we're going to default to increasing our window size. We have to packet drop by decreasing window size. And something I want to point out here is that I'm making an assumption here that most of our packet loss is from congestion. That this scheme actually works pretty poorly if we have lots of non-congestion packet losses. So like if we just have a noisy wireless connection where we lose some of our data across the wireless link because of radio interference, not because there's other people trying to communicate on it, then we're going to interpret all that radio sort of just, you know, our radio's too far away stuff as I need to lower my sending rate, which may not help deal with that issue. And that's just a problem with this scheme. This is a reason why, if you look at what wireless sort of protocols do, they often have hop-by-hop acknowledgments. And a big reason for this is because that makes things that use congestion control on top not have these non-congestion losses, which they're just bad at dealing with. Even though, yes, they will handle them. But as an optimization, right, we talked about the end-to-end principle, we're going to not rely on the network doing anything. But as an optimization, it can implement this extra functionality. And wireless networks do because it's a big optimization, given our reaction is going to be normally when we have a loss to say, I must be sending too fast, slow down. So we're going to start by answering the main question of how fast to do each. And to think about that, I want to point out like what this congestion collapse scenario, what was going on with it? And so let's do an example here where let's say I have a switch that can handle 50 packets a second. And I have 100 packets from one flow and 10 packets from another going through this 50 packet a second bottleneck. So some questions. What's my expected loss rate in total and for each of these two flows? Give you a minute to work it out. Any proposals? People need more time? Yeah. So you had around 55%. How did you get that? For the first question?
Yeah.
How did you get that?
Just adding up the total amount of packets sent and then the amount that it could handle. So if it lost 60, then it would just mean 60 packets over 110
minutes. Okay, so we have 100 plus 10 sent over 50 handled, so minus 50 sent handled. Sent and 50 handled. 50 sent, 50 got through. And so this is equal to 60 over 110. Okay, that's a reasonable. Is there any other opinions? Okay, how about our other questions? The next question, what percent of the test flow that 100 packet a second flow packets are lost? Or is there information we need that we don't have? Yeah.
How does the switch decide which packets to drop? Like, could it drop all of the 60 packets from the test flow or all of the packets from the second session, or will it split it up?
Yeah, so the question, how we need to know how the switch decides which packets to drop when it has choices. And there's actually two things, a thing related to that we would want to know is, like, how does the switch receive these packets? Are they evenly spaced or not? And all this stuff actually does matter. And in fact, matters for the first question even. So, like, one important question are these spent in burst or not? Because maybe the switch can handle 60 packets, 50 packets a second, but it only has a queue of size 10. So if you send 40 packets all at once, you'll run out of space. And as we'll talk about as our topic after congestion, there's actually multiple good ways of managing the switch's queue. So the switch could make deliberate choices between the flow, or it could have sort of different ways of deciding what to drop. And also, it matters sort of how the flow, not just that the flow is bursty or not, but whether it's like evenly spaced, because if things are evenly spaced, sometimes they'll like exactly synchronize, so you always get one flow dropped. For this problem, let's kind of simplify and say that the flow's arrivals are randomly spaced and drops hit packets at random. Yeah, so by randomly spaced, I mean it's 100 a second, but like the timing in between them is not exactly even. It's just, you know, spread out as if we had a timeline and we threw darts at that timeline to decide when the send happens. Or if you remember your probability, there's an exponential distribution for the time between when we send packets. And that the queue is pretty big, so all our drops are from exceeding the overall capacity, not from any short bursts. All these things could be false and will actually affect our results. And so let's go through my answers here. And sorry, I forgot I changed this slide, so I increased this to 20 and didn't increase the earlier slide. But it's the same idea. We get our loss rate of the total over the capacity. So the total actually sent, missing over the capacity, which gets up to 58, not 55 when we add the 20 instead of 10. And because of that sort of assumption that kind of it's just random which flow gets hit, because they're kind of just sort of evenly spaced out, which is, you know, typically going to be our first guess, even though that's obviously not actually true in practice, everyone will miss something. But there's another thing that I didn't really specify that's kind of important here. And that's my assumption is that we're going to have 120 packets sent, even though we have packet loss. So what would happen in your reliable part one implementation? What do you do when there's packet loss? Or reliable part two?
You resend.
So what actually is going to happen here, if these are like TCP, if these are reliable transports, that they would like to do 120, but they're going to go higher they're going to ramp up if we don't stop them. And with this packet loss rate, it's going to ramp way up. Or, so this should be 20 here. Not going to ramp up that much, but we can figure out they're going to ramp way up. So if our 20 packet a second flow, it's going to ramp like double from all the retransmissions, because 58% are going to be retransmitted. And in fact, some 58% of those, that 58% are going to be retransmitted a second time. We're going to have tons of extra traffic, causing more load on the switch, meaning our drop rate actually goes up to like 66%. And something you might notice is like I computed this assuming our drop rate is 58%, but this phenomena increases it to 66. So actually this 48 is an underestimate. It's going to go even higher because our retransmissions are going to induce even more packet loss. Increase that rate a little higher. So we're going to have this extra high drop rate, and this is what the congestion collapse phenomenon is. So it's really important to avoid this because we have this positive feedback loop that if we don't act aggressively enough when we have this packet loss situation, we're just going to make the problem way worse. And that's just like the way your reliable part two code works. That it's just going to make the problem way worse than it already was because you're going to do all those retransmissions. And this is not only going to be bad in terms of sort of our network utilization, like this connection is going to be really horrible. And it's also going to be really horrible for latency. So with 58% loss, we're going to resend every packet 2.5 times. Packet average sent 2.5 times, right? Because most packets are going to resend once, at least. Some are going to send more than once. So it averages out, we're going to send everything 2.4 times. And this means our kind of average time to transmit something is not half a round trip time. That's our normal if we assume it's symmetric in both directions. It's going to be like, we're going to have an extra 1.4 round trip times to actually get data across. So our latency also increases. So if we care about not just bandwidth, but we care about latency, our latency is going way up from all of these retransmissions. And this is our average latency. If we care about like spikes in latency, that's even worse. Because like 1% of the time, if you do the math, if we assume this random distribution of losses, we're gonna need 8 retransmissions. So 1% of the time, we're gonna have more than 8 times, 16 times the normal latency. So, if we think of like this, if this is an interactive thing, this is horrible. So congestion collapse, real bad. So we're going to be very aggressive about how we react to packet loss because it's so bad. We don't want this to happen. It's going to make everything horrible for us and everyone else using the bottleneck, that same link. So that's going to be... And that's going to also guide what we do for the increase. So I'll start with the increase side. So one part of the intuition of this is not only do we want to decrease aggressively, we don't want to increase aggressively. If we increase too aggressively, we're going to keep triggering this congestion collapse sort of positive feedback loop. And so the TCP authors, in that Van Vapersen paper, they chose to increase, but they chose to increase pretty slowly. In particular, their choice was one packet per round trip time. So every round trip time, they increased the window size by one packet. And you might say this must be the result of some like detailed computation of the trade-offs. No, it wasn't. It's a guess. There is an important theoretical aspect. I'm not sure they knew this theoretical aspect when they exactly decided this, but it's been well analyzed now. We'll talk about it later when we talk about sharing connections. There's an important reason about it that it's additive, right? That we're adding one packet. We're not like adding 10%. We're adding a constant. So additive means here that sort of plus constant, not plus X percent, right? Not a multiplicative increase or something worse. And that's a deliberate choice because if we do something multiplicative, we get this kind of exponential increase, and that would be something that's likely to trigger our congestion collapse. And it's going to turn out this additive increase from a sort of theoretical mathematical perspective is really nice for thinking about what happens when I have two connections both doing this at the same time. It's going to be really convenient. So questions about this additive increase? And I guess something I should mention is that I read it as one packet per round trip time, but sort of the typical implementation is plus sort of bytes on each ACK. We don't actually wait a full round trip time before increasing it. We typically, a common implementation is because TCP tracks the window size in bytes, we kind of increase it incrementally over time. So we don't have a spike, we have a kind of gradual increase, little increases for each packet. Yeah?
But even though we ask really adding the constant every time, once we trigger the retransmit though, it will suddenly pop up for them because of the retransmission. So what's the point of adding a slow in the beginning then? Because it's gonna...
So what's the point of adding slow in the beginning? So by increasing slowly, we're limiting the sort of total amount of packet loss we expect to happen. It's kind of the biggest thing, right? So there's going to be retransmission, but it's not going to be so much. Also, when we do our decrease, part of doing the decrease is that we're not going to bother retransmitting things that are no longer in our decreased window. So we're going to immediately not retransmit everything. We're going to kind of give up on some stuff. And that's going to help out with that. But indeed, we are going to trigger packet loss. We're going to trigger retransmissions. We're going to increase the load of the network. And our hope is that everyone reacts to this well enough that it's, and we have big enough buffers that it's not really a big deal. That the switches can absorb these temporary spikes well enough that we're not going to be in trouble. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your question? Or no? Other questions? So this additive increase factor was chosen in the 80s. And we can kind of show that by doing some computation here. So let's say I have a 50 millisecond round trip time to somewhere. And I'm initially sending at 600 packets a second. And the optimal rate for the link is 10,000 packets a second. How long is it going to take me to get to the optimal rate? Give you a bit of time to compute that. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on the computation. And you can think of this scenario as you have your home router and you were previously downloading a whole bunch of stuff, so your connection was slow, and now it's not slow anymore. How long is it going to take advantage of it not being slow? So Kasama telling you, good first thing to do to compute, to do this, to figure this out. Yeah?
We're adding one packet per every round trip time. Mm-hmm. So maybe subtract the optimal packets per second minus our current packets per second and multiply by the round trip time.
Okay, so you want to do, so you want to say, we want to add, so sort of the additional packets a second added equals that. Okay, so I like this idea. So something you're missing that's subtle is that a bigger issue is that one packet per round trip time means that the increase, that when we increase the window size by one packet, we're increasing the transmission rate implies that we're increasing about one packet. This is one packet per 50 milliseconds. So we're increasing the transmission rate by more than one packet a second. Like, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's not that bad. But I like your idea, but you have to be careful that, you know, when we add one to the window size, we're adding one per round trip time. And so this ends up adding, getting us up by about like 20-ish packets per second. So one way you can compute this is that this is therefore 20 packets a second. And the question is, how often do we do that increase? And we do that every 50 milliseconds. So we're kind of doing 400 packets a second, right? Increase. So we can do that math. We can divide here by 400 to find out the number of seconds. So that is indeed one way we could compute this. Some questions on that method of computation? The reasoning there is. I have work on the slide where I did it differently. I computed the window size, so I said our window size now is 30. Because we're transmitting 600 packets a second. How many packets are we transmitting in 50 milliseconds? 30. So our window size is 30. We want to get to 500 window size. We're going to increase the window size by one every round trip, so we need 470 round trips. And that works out to about 24 seconds. So if you think of like you're downloading something, you may or may not consider this acceptable, that your download takes 24 seconds to ramp up. That seems kind of bad. It's not horrible, it's livable, but it's not great. And this wasn't a concern in the 80s because no one had connections with these kinds of numbers. But obviously that's pretty common these days. So you might say, why was this terrible? There's kind of two fixes that make this not such a big problem in practice. And one of the fixes is in that original paper. And that's that when we start the connection, we're not going to be in additive increase mode. We're going to be in a different mode we'll talk about later called slow start. And slow start, I have in quotes every time because it's not slow. It's fast. Calling it slow start is, I don't understand why, but it's fast. It's actually fast. It's going to deal with this problem for connection setup. But it doesn't deal with the problem for, like, we had little bandwidth and now we have a lot more bandwidth. It doesn't deal with that problem still. There are some more modern solutions to it. So there's some variants of TCP that kind of decided we don't need to do this additive increase idea all the time. So they have some heuristics where they figure out, oh, it's probably safe to increase faster than additive in this case. And we'll talk briefly about them, about one of them, Cubic, later. And why Cubic? Because it turns out it's the algorithm that pretty much every system, every like desktop or laptop used OS defaults to these days. Okay, so that's increase. So we have this slow increase, one packet per round trip time. And we want to do decrease. And the original TCP heuristic is basically we divide by two. And that's what they proposed, Jacobson proposed first, that basically you divide by two to a minimum of one packet. And you might say, how do they come up with two? Well, again, just like the plus one wasn't important, the two isn't the important part. The divide is the important part. So it's going to be important that this is a multiplicative decrease. We're multiplying by one half. We're not like subtracting 10 or something like that. We're multiplying by something. And again, later on, we'll show that this has good behavior between flows. And I guess something I should mention, because it will come up on the assignment, is when we decrease sort of need to not resend packets that are now out of window. Since this will be a subtlety on reliable part three, is that if we decrease our window size, part of the reason we're doing that is to stop overloading the network. And a subtle thing you can easily miss is that if we have a timeout for some of those later packets, you can't send them anymore if your window size got too small. You need to say, that would overload the network. You know, I need to stop doing that. I need to wait to send these until later, until when my window goes back up to include them. And a key part of why we're doing this dramatic window size reduction is because we want to kind of immediately stop adding stuff to the network. You know, let it recover from what's going on. Okay, so questions? Out here. Okay, so when we combine this increase and decrease rule, we get what's known as additive increase, multiplicative decrease, commonly abbreviated AIMD. And this is kind of the basics of the congestion control that is almost always what you'll see in any protocol on any internet-like network. GCP uses it, but pretty much this is basically the kind of key idea in almost all congestion control you see. So as I mentioned, there's some systems that kind of stray away from it by doing like not quite additive in some cases, and maybe not quite multiplicative in some cases, but this is our key idea. And it's going to be important for us to show that this behaves well when we have multiple connections, as we'll see a bit later. And to kind of give an idea of how this actually works out, so here is a diagram from a paper on a congestion control mechanism called T-Vegas that we will talk briefly about later, but they were plotting so-called TCP Reno, which is basically standard TCP. It's called Reno because of where some conference was, I think. And this is a trace of what was going on in a simulation. And the light gray line here, that's the window size in their simulation. And you can see the window size has this sawtooth pattern when there's losses, like we have this dramatic decrease. And that's kind of what typically ends up happening. And we'll talk about this dotted line I mentioned is the slow start threshold. We'll go back to that when we talk about slow start. Questions on this diagram here? Yeah.
So just by looking at it, does it mean slow start is just multiplying or increasing the first time?
So the question is slow start, multiplicative increase? Yes. And that's why I said doesn't sound slow. It's not slow. Other questions? So you can see that behavior. And I mentioned Cubic. So Cubic is kind of our default congestion control algorithm today. So it's been the default in Linux since 2006, in OS X since 2014, and in Windows since 2019. But pretty much That's what we're mostly using for kind of consumer systems. And the big change they make from the standard congestion control is that they increase faster than additive when you're further away from the time you had the last loss. So their intuition isn't if we've waited a while, we increase faster. Their intuition is that the last place I had a loss tells me that's probably the steady state. If I've wandered away from that, I need to figure out where the steady state is, so I need to move faster to get a loss to find that. That's kind of the intuition the authors have. But if I'm close to the steady state, I don't want to experiment a lot because I'll just be wasting my time triggering losses that probably won't tell me anything. It'll probably just tell me, yes, you were at the right window size. Don't fiddle with it. But if I haven't seen losses in a while, and I haven't seen losses around this window size, probably it means I'm way too low and I need to find out the high point. And it's called cubic because the kind of function for the increase has this saddle point. It's a cubic function with a saddle point. So the saddle point is where, you know, things get flat in the derivative. So that's why it's called cubic, because it is based on a cubic function for deciding how to vary from that. And here are some figures from the cubic paper kind of showing what happens with the window size and the bat throughput. And so you can see that the window size, they're growing not linearly. They're growing this sort of fast growth when they're away from a last event and slow growth when they're close to the last time they had a loss. And this is showing, but they still have, you know, they still have the multiplicative decrease, and, you know, it's not additive increase, but it's close to additive increase. Just a tweak on additive increase for this special case. Okay, so questions on kind of our basic AIMD idea. Okay, so I mentioned that non-congestion losses are bad. So let's talk about how bad. So let's say I have a 1% loss rate from transmission errors, not from queues going a bit too big. What is my expected window size and bandwidth with that, with a 50 millisecond round trip time? Give you some time to think about that. So assume I have a connection that can handle like a ton of bandwidth, but I have these losses 1% of the time. 1% of packets get lost because the radio is staticky. How fast am I actually going to get if I'm using additive increase, multiplicative decrease with a kind of plus one packet per round trip time, half the window size on loss, the standard TCP heuristics? Someone want to tell me your first step for doing this? Yeah.
I have a feeling it's going to be just like the addition of the power sequence of 99%. It's because like every time it's like it's just there's going to be 99% to kind of like a very high power.
99%. And what's that going to tell us?
It's getting slower and slower, like, as time goes on.
So you think it's just going to keep getting slower and slower?
Yes, because you were trying to retransmit the loss every time, and the loss is getting more and more every time.
Okay, so that's one theory. Other theories? I guess I probably should have run this in a simulator to like get a real answer. I have a computed answer slide, but other theories or other ideas for starting? So the way I think about this is with a 1% loss rate, kind of a trivial way to kind of estimate what happens is that every 100 packets gets lost. And so the way I think about that is we start at some window size and we increase it until we transmit 100 packets and then we half the window size. Right, that's what we expect to happen kind of in the average case. Probably it's actually not 100 between each thing and I need to count, I'm not counting for retransmissions fully, you know, which are gonna make that off by a little bit or potentially more than a little bit. But what I say is, okay, if we increase the window size for 100 packets, then half it, sort of what's gonna happen when we do that? And if I kind of look experimentally at what happens, if I think of a window size of 8, we're gonna transmit 8 packets, then 9 packets, then 10 packets, then 11 packets, then 12 packets, up to transmitting 16 packets, and then we'll have a loss. Then our window size will go down to 8. And then we'll go repeat that process. So I would guess our steady state is approximately that our window size will fluctuate between 8 and 16. Even though we have way more capacity because we're interpreting each of these sort of random losses as congestion. And that means we have like 250-ish packets a second that we can send here. So, and this kind of illustrates why, you know, these non-congestion losses are pretty bad for TCP performance, right? Because we're going to interpret them as I need to slow down, and we're going to slow down a lot because our rule says to slow down a lot, because if we don't, the network collapses. Yeah?
So are we always going to decrease the window size at any packet drop, even if it's just like one?
Yeah, are we going to decrease it at just one? Yes. Yeah, that's the heuristic. So we could imagine having schemes where we do something more aggressive, but then the question is, like, how much are we risking, you know, having, you know, that congestion collapse phenomenon happening? And the answer is probably we could be a little more aggressive, but how much more is an open question, right? It feels kind of dangerous to experiment with that. Other questions? Okay, so I talked about our basic scheme, and we're kind of just assuming we're playing alone in the network so far, right? I said we had cross-traffic, but the way I modeled that is I just said basically our link gets slower or faster. But we know what's actually happening most of the time is that our so-called cross-traffic, the other connections, are doing the same thing we're doing. They're trying to slowly increase how much bandwidth they use and reacting the packet loss by rapidly decreasing the bandwidth that they use. What's that going to do? And this is kind of a very, you know, important question, and we have a bunch of things we want to know. Like, one thing is, like, is this actually going to be stable? Right? If we're slowly increasing, decreasing, are we actually going to, like, basically get sort of roughly constant bandwidth? We know it's not going to actually be constant. It's going to have this sawtooth pattern, but, you know, is it going to be close enough to constant, or is it going to be like sort of all over the place? You know, we're going to see 1 kilobyte, 1 megabyte, 1 kilobyte, 1 megabyte, that sort of thing. Also, is it fair? Is an important question, right? Is it the case that in my scenario here, that whoever started first uses all the bandwidth and no one else gets any bandwidth, right? That would be bad. We don't want that scenario. We want to share the links. We don't want there to be a winner and a loser, especially not a winner and a loser based on, like, who's first. So I'm going to show you that sort of our two key ideas, that we had an additive increase, that we added a constant number per round trip, and we had a multiplicative decrease, that is going to be sufficient for us to have good sharing of this link. And I'm going to show you some diagrams for this based on a paper by Chu and Jane that was published in 1989. And you may notice that they probably didn't know this in 1981 when they invented TCP, which is why bad things happened. And this paper has this very nice visualization of what happens with two connections, and we're going to look at two connections. They also like do the math to prove things for arbitrary numbers of connections using the same strategy. I'm not going to go through that because we probably don't need to do proofs with vector arithmetic in this class. But this gives you a good intuition for what's going on. And so our picture with two connections is that I have flow 1 and flow 2. And we're going to choose how much bandwidth each of them gets. And we have a link capacity. And basically, any point along this dotted line fills our link exactly with some mix of flow 1 and flow 2. And if they're getting an even share, we want to go, we're going to have that midpoint here. And if we're above this dotted line, we're overloading the link. That we're trying to send too much, and both of our flows are going to experience packet loss. Under our kind of random assumption, it's going to be evenly distributed between the two flows. And we're going to assume that here. We're going to hope that like when we're in this region here, this overloaded region, both flows are going to lose packets, and they're both going to drop their congestion window. And when we're in this underloaded space, we have excess capacity, so we can safely increase by more, and so on. So let's say we're in this overloaded region. So flow 1 and flow 2 are both collectively using more than they should. And what's going to happen is they're going to do a multiplicative decrease. And that multiplicative decrease is going to sort of multiply both their bandwidths by, if they're decreasing the same way, which is what we're going to assume, by a single number. In this case, I'm multiplying by 1/2, but whatever we multiply, it's going to be on this line to the origin. Right? That multiplying by a constant puts us somewhere on this line. That's just how that multiplication works. So we're going to go back towards the origin on that line. That's going to be the reaction to these to this overloading. So we're going to end up having both flows in this white region on that line. So at that point, they're underloaded, and we're going to do an increase. And the increase is going to be by a constant, and assuming the flows sort of increase by the same amount, that's going to go on a 45-degree angle, and they're going to keep increasing until they end up in this overloaded region. So they're going to go on this kind of 45-degree angle line into this overloaded region. And we're going to repeat that process. They're going to go into the overload region, go towards the origin region. And it turns out that this converges towards that equal bandwidth line. That kind of sawtooth pattern gets closer and closer to the equal bandwidth line because that multiplicative decrease gets us closer to the origin and our additive increase doesn't take us further away from the line. It's parallel to that sort of ideal equal bandwidth line. It also tells us we need to have losses to have this convergence happen, right? We can't, if we don't increase quickly enough, we won't trigger going towards the origin, we won't actually fairly share the connection. But as long as we do that, you know, and we give enough time for this sort of convergence to happen, we'll actually end up roughly fairly sharing the link. And I've kind of showed this diagram for two connections, but it turns out the math works out for three or four or five. Under the kind of assumptions we have here, which is that, you know, when we're in this overloaded space, everyone has congestion, and we have the same additive increase factor, so we have that 45 degree. And also the same multiplicative decrease factor, because that was necessary for us to be on that line to the origin. Yeah?
Don't you leave a lot on the table, though? Because isn't the intersection of those two lines, like, an optima for both? So it's like...
So the question is, you know, aren't I ending up operating like in this region instead of like there? Yes. So we can tweak. So yeah, we aren't we're leaving some capacity on the table. How much, like in practice, is, you know, this might be an exaggeration of how much we're actually gonna leave on the table, because probably like this is actually window size, right? And this is window size, and it's not the same as bandwidth, because this is probably the maximum bandwidth, and then we have some space where we increase the window size, but we're filling the buffers, not actually getting more bandwidth. So it's probably not as bad in practice, but yes, we deliberately, we waste packets, right? We have to have drops, we're wasting packets. We're not gonna achieve 100% utilization. And this is kind of a fundamental issue because we don't have things synchronized, right? We don't have a central scheduler, so we always have to deal with the case where things kind of randomly sync up in a way where we overload our capacity. Even though if we schedule things perfectly, we could fully utilize the link, we're never gonna be able to fully utilize the link, even if we chose the rates without the scheme, because we don't have the flows exactly synchronized to make sure we never run out of queue space and all that stuff. Question?
Yeah, so if maybe like one flow is faster to receive information than the other flow, then doesn't a slow flow get like advantage in this sharing bandwidth scenario because it will like decrease its bandwidth at a later time?
So the question is, if one flow gets information slower than another flow, doesn't have a disadvantage in this scenario. So I guess an assumption we're making is that both flows will experience a single congestion event when the network is overloaded. If that's not actually the case, this doesn't work. And I think that's the scenario you're imagining, is that we might have cases where only one flow experiences a congestion event.
Yeah, or it gets that event earlier, actually.
Or it gets that event earlier. I think getting that event earlier shouldn't affect the isn't a big issue, because in overall we'll have the same multiplicative decrease happen. That shouldn't be a big deal. But indeed, if only one gets the congestion signal, it is going to be cause us to diverge.
No, actually, it should lean toward one of the
axes. Yeah, it will lead away, and that flow will be disadvantaged. There's another problem we'll talk explicitly about later, related to how fast flows learn about things, but it's related to the additive increase. Okay, other questions? Okay. And so something I'd like to point out, so here I'm assuming both flows can kind of fully utilize the link. And a nice thing about this scheme is that like it also works when they can't. So let's say we have a scenario here where I have two connections, and this here is a slow link. And I have these two connections sharing this non-slow link. Like, how is that going to actually work out with this scheme? And it turns out it works out the way we want, basically, under our normal assumptions that both flows see congestion. And a way we can reason about that is that we have our slow that uses the slow link, and it's going to get drops in this kind of triangle region. This is drops from the slow link that only flow 2 is using, right? So flow 2 is limited to a lower bandwidth by that link in front of the bottleneck. And if we exceed too much, both flows start getting drops. And that's fine. So we're going to have congestion events here where both flows get drops. We're going to have congestion events where flow 2 gets a drop, but flow 1 keeps increasing its bandwidth since it doesn't have congestion. So in this case, we're going towards down here, we're going away. And if we're in this region here where flow 1 isn't using its full bandwidth and flow 2 isn't using the full bandwidth, we're going to increase at that 45-degree angle. And if we combine sort of all the directions these go, we're going to actually converge to this point here, which is exactly what we want. So this scheme kind of for free gives us basically the right sharing, even when we have sort of other bottlenecks going on that aren't, you know, so different bottlenecks are limiting. It still works out. Yeah.
Yeah, so is that like perfect 45 degree angle, like where they two converge? Like, is that like a percentage of flow on employees max bandwidth, like equaling out, or?
Is this 45 degree angle, so you mean the increase we're having here? Why is that a 45 degree angle?
Well, I mean, like just that point we're converging on, like is there a reason that like essentially that's the optimal point where both flow and employee bandwidth are like the same? Like, I'm trying to understand what that.
So question, why am I calling that point optimal? So I guess it's the point that we converge to in this scheme for whether you like it or not, right? It's the point we're going to end up getting kind of circling around given sort of the dynamics of how our window sizes move. I would also argue that it's kind of the fairest point for this scenario. And the reason I'd argue that is that if we start at this point and we try to give flow one more bandwidth, we are going to be starving flow two of bandwidth, even though flow two already has less. If we try to give flow two more bandwidth, it can't use it. So I would argue it's the fairest point that we can choose. And also it happens to be the point we end up converging to. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so next time we'll talk a little bit more about fairness. But I would say, like, as I said, this is fair because we can't give more to the least advantaged flow without hurting someone else, right? It's the kind of the best we can do. It follows that definition of fairness. And we're gonna talk about next time about there's a case where this scheme isn't fair, and that's because the assumption I made here doesn't actually work all the time. The assumption that this is a 45 degree angle isn't always true. So that's where we'll lead off next time and talk about some other congestion control topics.